Hello and welcome to EdTech Talks discussion of Dave's new book, Learning in a Time of Abundance. This week we are discussing Chapter One, Change Has Never Been a Bargain. I am Jeff Lebo in Busan, Korea.
My name
Dave
is Jessica.
Cormier.
Oh, I think I'm next.
He's
I thought
out
you
of
were next.
practice. He,
I'm
yeah.
sorry. Sorry. Although it was kind of an introduction when you said that. But my name is Jennifer Madrill in Laval, Wisconsin.
You want me to go next? I might as well go
Yes.
next. This is John Shinker in Stowe, Ohio.
And I'm Dave Cormier in Windsor, Ontario.
So
So
my first question was going to be,
book.
you know, it's been a number of years since we've done this on a regular basis, and I was going to ask how everyone's doing after last week's return to webcasting. Any sore webcasting muscles or flashbacks to the 2000
Clearly, we're all back 100% ready to go, like we
aughts?
never missed a beat.
Pretty much how I remember things, Jeff.
Yeah, we should
Good
clarify the
times.
order in our pre-show.
My microphone doesn't work, Jennifer's camera doesn't work, and nobody knows when to talk. So other than that, we're great.
I logged in 90 seconds before we started. So yeah, seems pretty much the
Before we jump into chapter one, any highlights from the past week? Any edtech news or exciting things to share?
You know, it's funny you say that because I've been working away on stuff this week trying to get my head around. I did a couple more AI presentations, more of my March of Sadness. I was part of a three-part conversation with some folks on Thursday, and we're seeing schools really try to find a positive narrative. Like, what's the positive narrative look like? Like, it seems like we've transitioned. It's like everybody has now turned the corner. It's funny because I only feel like it's been the last 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, but now everything I'm reading is people, what's the positive input? How are we going to integrate this in? How are we going to get this done? So
This being AI.
AI, yeah.
I think we started at staying away from the fear. Like, it wasn't a, you know, we should block this, we should stop it, we should try to keep people from using it. Like, from the very beginning, we were, this is here and our students are going to use it, so let's find a way to navigate forward. I think what I've been seeing the last, I don't know, this calendar year for sure, maybe the last couple months, is the move away from how do we use AI to do the same old things better? You know, so all of the marketing is, oh, it can write your recommendation letters for you, and it can create lesson plans, and it can grade your essays and whatever. And we're really, our teachers are actually pushing, how do I use this to improve student engagement? How do I create innovative project-based learning things for my kids to do that are relevant to them? So, like, using the AI to sort of help do the things that are hard to quantify instead of just doing the repetitive tasks faster or better. So that leaves me optimistic that we can find ways to use AI to leverage it with our people to make learning better for kids.
All right, the optimism spreads. I had an exhilarating week having a bunch of media to play with and publish for the first time. And so EdTech Talk now has an Instagram and a TikTok and a Threads. And I'm never going to say like and subscribe, be aware and ignore, but they do exist.
Be aware,
And
ignore. It's sorry.
just becoming literate, you know, I haven't really published a lot of media in years, and just becoming literate in shorts and the publishing format and how things work was just a week of learning and excitement for me. We're killing it in Korean TikTok because when you publish the TikTok, it uses your SIM card to identify where you are. VPNs wouldn't change anything. So it's going, we're like 99% Korean market, but we're getting a surprising number of likes, like more than 200 views and a bunch of
Wow.
likes. Although that's the way TikTok works. Everyone talks about the getting beyond the 200 line. I think it just tosses it out to 200 people, and if it's getting a lot of engagement, it'll keep going. And if not, you get stuck there. And my project for this week is going to be getting up to speed with modern podcasting. Oh, how I miss
It
FeedBurner
did
because
pop
there's
up in my feed because, you know, I'm still subscribed, and
Oh,
then
it
it wouldn't,
did.
yeah, and then it wouldn't play the episodes. An error occurred. Try watching this video on youtube.com or enabled JavaScript, which is odd
So
because it's
I've
a
got some work to do this
dedicated
week.
feed app, but you know, it's there, which is cool.
Well, this is such a perfect segue to our conversation tonight. You'd almost think that Dave had thought about these things before he started writing his book and been thinking about them for years. But should we hop in? Should we hop in? Or do you have anyone else? All right. Very good. Okay. So to kind of like in the format we did last week, if you guys are okay with it, I'm just going to kind of pepper Dave with some questions. And then I've got questions for us to kind of come back through at the end to kind of think about. So chapter one, as we've said, the coverage is on implications of technological innovation. And so before we start, it's just kind of my aside. My master's degree was at Indiana University in instructional systems technology. And this is a huge part of what we covered way back when, you know, 20 whatever years ago. And they were covering things that had happened from Rogers in the 50s and whatever on diffusion of innovation. So as I was going through it, it's like, oh my gosh, you know, the technology changes, the issues are the same, the adoption and, you know, laggards and all those, you know, the early adopters, all those types of things were kind of jumping out at me. So Dave, I just kind of wanted to start out, if you could kind of give us a sense, why did you start your book out with this? Like why, you know, this doesn't necessarily perfectly align with the title of your book or what we talked about. Is kind of the things about abundance and things like that, where you jumped right in talking about technology as a change process.
And Dave, to facilitate the publishing of reels and shorts, can you please limit your answers to 60 seconds of clever, witty banter?
No.
A more unreasonable request has never been made.
XP is going to be a problem.
You have no idea how much time I spent this week editing Dave.
Oh God. Now I'm all under pressure. So first I switched those chapters around about 17 times at the beginning. So with this kind of thing, where to start is always the question. Do you start talking about abundance? Do you start talking about uncertainty? Do you start talking about the education system? And I think what I was trying to do was get people in the mindset of their own experience rather than the education experience or the theory experience, but really where you're at as a person. And that technological shift is one that people have some kind of direct relationship to. So I was hoping it was the softest start of all of the different options, because it's not really a book about schools, though it, I think, has implications for how we think about schools. It's a book about how we learn and how that has to adjust as we go forward. And I, like, for instance, the reason why I chose the telephone example is it's something that everybody can have some kind of relationship to. And it's interesting because I get much better feedback about this stuff from older people. And I think it's because they've seen more of the transition. So the people who have talked to me about this book who are in their 70s are all like, and I remember having this argument with somebody about how we were supposed to use answering machines. And then I remember the first time that I was on a call with Jimmy, and you get the whole story starts to blow up, right? I was hoping it would hit people where they were from. 60 seconds, Chef.
Nicely done.
Nicely done. But yeah, I mean, maybe this is I'll kind of, maybe we'll pepper some questions to the other two, but I have always considered, and I'm going to kind of bridge to now technology integration and bringing technology into the learning systems and what we do as being a change process because of, like I said, kind of my background with it. So, you know, John, you spend your day trying to get folks up and running on technology and responding to things that are coming in. Have you ever thought of the technology integration and the change aspects of it and how it's changes to the system and how people react to that change and those issues?
I think so. I mean, I think that often I remark more about what it doesn't change and how, you know, we've spent 20 years on educational technology and we've invested all of this time and money into infrastructure and professional development and learning theory. And then you walk in a classroom and it looks very much like it did when I was a student there. I think that the change that we see is more subtle than that. The cultural institution that is school looks like school and looks like school has always looked, but some of the things that are going on are different and technology helps us do those things. I don't know if that answers the question at all. I think that the technology is more incremental rather than transformational. So it, you know, new things become very shiny and kind of blow up and flash. And then you come back to it a second time or a third time, and then it starts to have a real impact and sort of change the way we do things. So I guess I'm often skeptical of the new shiny thing, because often that new shiny thing has to go through a couple iterations before, you know, people think through the practicality of what the implications are.
Yeah, so are you buying Dave's argument in chapter one that this latest change is not incremental, that it is transitional, transformational?
I think that it took 25 years. It took 30 years, right? I mean, to go from information being scarce to information being abundant took a generation. And that's short in the span of human history, but it's not short within a person's lifetime. You know, if you look at the first time you guys did a webcast, right? There wasn't anybody on the internet yet to hear it. So it's one senator with a phone, but the other senators don't have phones yet.
That's why no one was listening.
That's why there were only, you know, you had 200 TikTok views because there were only 200 people on TikTok when you started, Jeff.
That was 1998, in case you're wondering, Jeff's webcast.
I think, though, yeah, and you're hitting on something that I think we could spend a lot of time talking about, and it is kind of my next question, was this difference between incremental change and transformational change, and the way you described it in the book. You can correct me if I'm paraphrasing incorrectly here, but basically that incremental change is just doing something, it's replacing something. Like we're not necessarily doing something that is significantly different. It has a significant impact in our lives. So I think kind of our first conversation was, you know, AI is now having the opportunity potentially to do something we've never been able to do, maybe. It'd be kind of interesting to kind of dissect that statement, because, you know, maybe we can find ways it was, but like really when you think of our webcasting and what we were doing before, we were kind of sort of replicating the radio and finding a new way to reach people, and maybe there was some degree of interaction with your audience that was a little bit different, but kind of what are your thoughts on that, Dave, because clearly you made a big distinction talking about incremental transformational and trying to set the boundaries on what the two are, so you kind of want to riff on that a little bit.
For sure, I agree with John. I don't think it's been transformational in schools, because in schools, what you have is a gigantic, stable, resilient curriculum that a bunch of technology has been pushed up against, right? So I don't think it's been transformational in the places that I've seen it. There are certainly things that happen in schools. There are some people who are doing transformational work with specific technologies at specific times in schools. But broadly speaking, no, it's not true. It's transforming the system, because the system comes through a giant bureaucratic load and takes a long time to do anything. For me, the transformation has happened in our lives, not in the school, but the way that we learn outside of the school. So if you take, I keep thinking of the little old Italian lady I never had the courage to ask about her cooking, who lived around the corner from me down the street here, who obviously cooked for the people in her like area, would come outside with food, and there's this whole thing that I could see. And she would have been my only access to whatever it is she was cooking 30 years ago. Like that ability to access information outside of the place that you grew up was go to a bookstore and try to find a random book about it, maybe, right? That access is something that changed. And I'll disagree with John on this point. It hasn't taken 25 years. I think it took me 25 years to figure out what I was trying to say, which makes me dumb. But I don't think it's like magically just started now. I think that as soon as you've got that sort of availability of the internet, once it crosses that 50% range inside of a society, where people are no longer beholden to their neighbors for information, where they're no longer constrained by their community. So like, Jeff, I'd love to hear from your perspective what it's like for someone to have moved to Korea when you did, and what it's like for someone to move there now. Like, to me, that's the difference.
And, you know, I can talk about, oh my goodness, it has changed so much in A, B, and C way. Someone who's moved here 10 years ago would say the same thing. Oh my God, it's changed so much from their perspective. You know,
but from an information gathering perspective, like, the way you had to find information, I got there in 98 and you're like 2 years before, I think.
Yeah, 95. So, Yeah, I mean, but well, that's true. You know, living as an expat, I had no access to my home country's media and news, and that was much more challenging. And the internet, you know, I could go to the old CNN.com or whatever and watch the page slowly load. Now I watch whatever I want, pretty much the same stuff I'd be watching if I was living in the States. I get the media from everywhere. Where I am does not affect the media that I consume or the information I am exposed to.
How did you teach yourself to read Korean?
I got a book and spent about 3 hours.
It's actually really easy.
King Sejong
It's
did a
only
great
26
job.
characters, 24 characters. But it's all that sort of difference in how you would accrue information. I remember showing up in a, I won't give you guys the region in Busan, but it's a random area in Busan, and not having a map and not having any idea what anything said and not having any idea where to go and having no pathway to find that out. So basically I had to walk from store to store, walk into the store to find out what kind of store it was, and then and slowly find a place that I later found out was probably not a place I should have stayed. But now you would open up your phone and you would find the places that will take the hotels in the nearby area. You'd find the restaurants, you'd find the reviews, you'd find all those things for
Or you
wherever
hold
you
up the
ended up.
phone and point it at the sign and it translates it in real time and tells you what it, yeah.
So the point here is that daily life has been transformed by prevalence of the internet, but that school systems have not been transformed yet.
That's the position I would take up, yeah. And
Yeah,
I
and I
think
think
that the way that we learn has not adjusted to the way that we learn in everyday life,
you
right? And
should write a book about that.
good idea.
But I think that's where it ties back to what I was saying with my tie-in to like Rogers and diffusion of innovation. There are huge obstacles and barriers within the system that are pushing up against it. And so, some of the things that hopefully we'll get some time to talk about are like the implications of change. There's like positive implications, then the negative. And so certainly when I started my semester this year at UVA, we had our first session on academic integrity issues around AI. And so those types of issues, those potential negative consequences are kind of within the system working to say we're going to ban it because we're so scared of it and we're not going to even explore the positives. And so I think that's where some of those kind of like systemic issues and diffusion of innovation to me are so interesting. It's like change the technology, change the issue, whether it's incremental or transformational. I think that gets to the heart of what John was saying and what you were responding
Is
to.
that fear or is it just skepticism?
I think that's just the cool part to explore because there's some people who are just like, look at our like over the years, the web heads or whatever. Like some people see that change as a potential and they just run with it. They're the pioneering spirits and then they run with it. And so we were saying 20 years ago that Web 2.0 was going to take over schools and it would be all kids would be on Twitter. Well, we can
It
tell you.
did. We just don't call it Web 2.0 anymore.
Now we well and
You know,
we don't let them go on the internet, right? We wouldn't let them go on. So yeah, so that those are some of the questions I have that follow is like I think it's kind of cool now with our benefit of hindsight looking back 20 years, how have we adjusted and how have we adapted to change over the years and how what can we draw from that as we now look at AI and other whoever who knows what else is on the horizon. But yeah, so Dave, did you have any comments like or like your distinction between incremental and transformational? Is that kind of where you wanted to leave it, or do you have anything else that we didn't cover on that? Like how you make that distinction?
I think just to one comment on one of the things that you said, I think inertia is the biggest piece of this.
I'm
Giant
sorry, the what?
systems,
The
it's
what?
inertia.
Oh, okay.
Giant systems just don't move. I don't think that people are pardon the expression, at the chalk face, are resistant overall. Some of them are. But if you ask a teacher about changing curriculum, they'll go, you know, I need to do assessments, right? And they're like, well, what do you mean? Like, well, we've got like standardized testing is coming up. So like, I need to get this stuff done. So like, I appreciate what you're saying, but if I don't grade this, the students aren't going to do the work. And if they don't do the work, they're not going to be ready for their test. If they're not ready for their test, then when they get to high school, they're not going to be ready for the tests. And then if they don't do that in high school, then when they get to university, they're not going to be ready for those big size classrooms to be able to succeed. And we're not going to be able to have any doctors. There should be no doctors anywhere in the world. Like literally that's the conversation as it goes. And then you say, but, and they're like, no, I totally agree with you. I just like, what would I do? Mm-hmm. Right. There's a giant system and the things we're talking about are transformational, which the system can't handle. It doesn't do transformational. It only does incremental.
Does that blanket statement apply to all education systems? I mean, certainly there are pockets of systems that might have been transformed, be it IB schools or Montessori or some alternative schools or teachers within schools that are adapting it.
They'd be the exception that proves the rule is what I would say. We have so many more people in traditional school systems. So you take Emilio Reggio or you take Montessori, or like there's in half a dozen schools I've talked to over the last couple of years who are like trying to make technology schools or trying to make those kinds of schools. And when you see what happens to them is they do transformational things, right? And then the parents stop paying them because they have an expectation of what they want and they're not getting it. And then slowly they become like traditional schools again.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, all of those schools you talk about are paid for by parents. And parents want the thing that they got before.
And Martin Weller points out before? That that's why the institutions survive. That's why universities are 400 years old. And there isn't any site you're using on the internet that's more than 20 years old. All the stuff that you started out using doesn't exist anymore. Like nobody's going to, I mean, they exist, I guess. Yahoo still exists. eBay still exists. But, you know, you're not going to GeoCities to set up a website anymore. The technology industry innovates quickly and burns out quickly. The educational institutions are the opposite of that. They innovate very slowly, but then they have the resilience to last for centuries.
Aren't the parental preferences based on outcomes and desired goals, be it getting into a good university or getting a good job or, dare I say it, becoming a well-rounded human being? And if the current system isn't achieving that and some alternative system is, aren't they going to prefer that?
No, I don't think so, Jeff. I mean, are there parents who understand the system deeply enough to understand the relationship between how their kid does in high school and how they get into university? Sure. Broadly speaking, though, high grades good, right? And as long as the grades are high, but not everybody's, because if everybody's grades are good, then my kid's grades being high don't count, right? And so they're not in a position to evaluate how well the system is doing. One, they're not in the school, so they don't see what happens on a daily basis anyway. And we don't talk about, like, if you look at the average system that talks to a parent, whether it be EDSB or school, whatever, John could list off all the names for you, but I've been in some of those conversations. At the end of the day, they tell parents how well a child has behaved and how well they've sort of done what they're supposed to do and what they grade they got on a test and whether they went to school, right? Those are not markers that are going to give a quality response to a parent.
And then how rigorous is the curriculum? So
how rigorous
years, how many years of calculus did they take in high school? So how many, you know, how much time did they waste learning math that they didn't need to know?
Is that how you feel as parents?
I had to teach my kid when they were in grade eight, how to play the game of school because they were trying to learn and it was really hurting them in class. So yeah. I explained to that child, I said, look, you're in a game. The teacher has something they want you to say. And every time you come up with something else, you're failing at that game. You don't have to believe it, but if you want to succeed inside this system, then it's up to you. But if you do want to win the game, then what you have to do is figure out what game the teacher is playing and just play it. This is not about learning. As soon as I told the child that, and we worked through that, their grades improved by like 15%. And they were watching. And then they managed to figure out how to con the teacher into letting them do whatever they wanted to, which is what they do now. So I totally
Well, this is very depressing. I hope you've got some good news by chapter 6.
We started out so optimistic, right? Yeah.
Look, and I'm not saying there aren't fantastic teachers in my kid's school or fantastic teachers all over the place. The problem is the system is incredibly resilient. So just to give you one more super optimistic view of the system and as it works, we've moved towards giving kids an amount of money in the university they're going to based on what their actual grade is. So 85 to 90, you get 1,000. 90 to 95, you get 2,000. 95 to whatever, you get 3,000. So the only thing that matters to the parent is what the actual grade is on the assignment. What they learned in it is not, well, they got a high grade, so they learned. Like, it's not that they don't care about learning. It's just they got a 95. They clearly did well. So increasingly, we're shoving ourselves into that sort of quantitative approach to learning that increasingly forces you towards the opposite of what we're talking about here, right? The opposite of sort of exploratory or trying to understand the complexity of a system, or when we move down a few chapters, uncertainty, all those things. We're getting further away from that when I think we should be going in the other direction.
Yeah, and that translates all the way through to college. I can give you an example. And I kind of gave you one earlier when I said we started out the semester talking about academic integrity, meaning, can I tell that the work you turned in is your work? Because I have to put a grade on this. And so the reaction at the beginning of the semester, I don't think it's changed much from the university, is we don't use AI to help generate our assignment. You know, the students should not be using it. That would be a violation of our honor code. I don't know how you'd ever detect. And then you get into issues of like, then I'm sitting here policing it. I'm not even teaching. I don't know what I am. What is my role? What is their role? I'm using AI to generate the lesson plan. They're responding to it with AI. And who's, you know, what are we grading even? You know, what is the outcome that we're trying to measure, let alone figuring out a way to measure it? And so I think that kind of plays in what, again, I was saying, is this whole idea with the system is just going to win because it's just much easier. And then I do want to make sure also, this might be a good segue to your example with the Senate and the phones, because I think the reaction within the system we're seeing in education, you know, this idea that we're going to first off ban it, you know, which is that's like the gut reaction. And then you get people freaking out. They don't want to learn it. You've got even, you know, like I was saying before, pioneers that are running out and trying it. And then they're kind of seeding the knowledge of to those that are the early adopters and things like that. So yeah, you want to kind of tie all this into your Senate example with the phones, and then we could kind of riff on that, how it compares.
So it was one of those things I just came across when I was reading about this. This is a story from 1930 in the U.S. Senate, where one day the people who do Senate business went inside the Senate and replaced all of the pick-me-up and yell-into-it phones with phones with a rotary dial on them. And the senators were furious because they didn't know how to. Suddenly they were forced to be the ones operating a telephone, right? So they used to pick up a telephone and talk to an operator who was the person who actually operated the phone. And we moved that up a step so that you could actually dial person directly. There are huge advantages and disadvantages to that from a practical standpoint, but there's a bunch of like day-to-day things that they were complaining about inside of the Senate notes, like, because they were trying to pass a bill to get rid of these phones. So how am I supposed to remember all these numbers? How am I supposed to, when I use two hands to use the telephone? And then it was like, I don't have enough light in my room. I can't even see the telephone, these small numbers, and I'm moving a dial and I keep calling the wrong person. And they're all things that, for those of you who don't know what a rotary phone is, please check the internet. But you know, I'm doing this thing. And for those of us who actually remember using one of those, you could dial the wrong person. It's hard, but you could. But that change, that the sort of technical change, had this huge sort of response. And I think a big part of it, and I think it's something we see anytime we look at the conversation around technology, its abundance, information, and its impact on people, is that people who are successful currently are very resilient. They're very resentful and also nervous and anxious about things that they don't know how to do. So picking up a telephone is something professionally everybody knew how to do one day, and the next day they had no idea. So then they're looking at this thing in their office and going, I used to have this feeling of comfort, pick it up, get me Jimmy, right? And now I have to find Jimmy's phone number first. Where did I put the numbers? And now it's over there. So how do I kind of move over? And suddenly I feel anxious about it. I don't know how to do it. And I think when we look at sitting around the table with decision makers, and I know John for sure has been in a bunch of these conversations. I'm sure, Jen, you've seen that as a consultant. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine, Jeff, you haven't been pulled in a half a dozen rooms a year to talk about
this. Best to avoid them, but yeah.
Right. But when you sit at those tables, people are like, there's a point at which you can just see them turn off. And you're like, oh, you're not listening anymore, are you? Like I went one step too far, and suddenly the changes I'm talking about don't make any, they, you do not want to engage with them anymore. And to me, that Senate example has all of those pieces, right?
About, by the way, my favorite part of the Senate example were the younger senators who said their version of, okay, boomer, like, we like it, it's actually more convenient. Figure out how to use a rotary dial.
Oh, yeah. Well,
and
sure.
And it's also the case where it's very visible that they don't know how to use the phone, right? Yeah. Because everybody knows when they call the wrong number, they're going to talk to somebody that they didn't intend to. It's very embarrassing for them. And, you know, we see that all the time, because the way people react to that is they make fun of the technology, right? Is my clicker going to, I can't connect to the projector, I don't understand, you know, and they make light of how complicated the technology is. You know, when my kids were in grade one, one of their projects was they grabbed a MacBook from the cart, they opened up their PowerPoint, they connected it to the projector, did their presentation, shut it all down, and went and sat down when, you know, they're 7 years old, and this was almost 20 years ago now. And, you know, but people with master's degrees and doctorates don't know how to connect the projector, and then they make fun of the technology because of that. It's the same thing. It's embarrassing to not know it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, and then there's fears too. I've had, you were saying, Dave, like having meetings. I've had teachers flat out just say, this is going to replace me. Why would I help promote a technology that's going to replace me? So there's that fear as well.
Sure.
Okay, so should I get into the questions I have for the group? Or do we have anything else? Do you want to say anything else about the chapter that we didn't, are there any main themes that I kind of missed?
No, I mean, this is such a great, it's so fun to talk this out. So no, I feel good about it. Please continue.
Yeah.
I can't imagine what's coming next, though.
I kind of hinted at a lot of the questions already. You know, we have our 20-year history, which I just always love to kind of tap into, because I just think the thing changes, but the issues don't for a lot of times. And so as a group, I just kind of wanted to kind of, let's just bounce some ideas off each other. Where did you start 20 years ago in terms of technologies that you thought were going to, first of all, did you think anything we've ever talked about would be transformational, or did you think it would be more incremental? Some of the things that we, EdTech Weekly, how did you view the things we were talking about?
I think the one that that blew me away the most was Writely. The first time I saw it, the first time I saw people use it, and everybody was in the document at the same time. And I was like, whoa, how is that even going to work? And for probably, I don't know, still now I do it, where I'll throw 50 people into the same document just for entertainment
mm-hmm.
value.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still entertained by it. I don't know that it's transformational. It is heavily, it's a big change, maybe not a transformational one, but it, the knock-on effects of it are really interesting. Like, anytime anybody sends me a doc file to work on, I get twitchy. Like, can you not share that someplace so I don't have to send back a version of it to you? Because I'm going to freak out. So that kind of, like, it's made those different changes in the way that we work together, but not a transformational change. But I still remember the first day when I first saw it. I was like, that can't work. How did they even make that work?
And then it was, how many people can we have in here?
Yeah, that's right.
The very next step was, how do we
break
this?
Break it.
And I think it was 30 initially.
Yeah.
I remember it might have been 20. I remember putting enough people in to break it, like, right off the bat. But yeah, that the way we collaborate, and I still, you're right, I get twitchy too when I see someone open, you know, a Word document or a PowerPoint or something, and it's like, I can't edit that. You were gonna have to,
yeah, there's versions, and it's like, oh no.
Updated final version.
Yeah.
And at least for me, this is not an issue of just old people, because my students have to be trained to use the Google Space. Some of them are familiar mm-hmm. with it, but some are used to sending Hangul files, which is the Korean word processing program, which only works in Korea. And you have to have that program in order to open or edit. And it takes them, like, they still just, well, I'll send you my assignment. No, you will publish it where you're supposed to publish it so I can have access to it. And that is lengthy process for some.
The thing that helped that in my world is, in K-12 education, everybody uses Chromebooks. And once Chromebooks were available, 85% of schools was the last number I heard, and that's been a while, give a Chromebook to every kid. And so the entire industry, if you can call K-12 education an industry, runs on Google. So the people who are dragging their feet, like sending, and it, the only entity that does it is the state, because the state of Ohio doesn't allow their employees to use Google Docs. So they're sending attachments and, you know, in Microsoft formats, but they're the only ones, right? So everybody else, even new superintendents coming in, new school board members, like everybody's already on board, which is super helpful.
Is that's a change from 20 years ago, because I feel like 20 years ago, Apple was dominant in the education space.
Yeah, I mean, Google and is more so now? I am in one of two schools in the county that uses Apple products with every kid. Every kid gets an iPad, and every staff member has an iPad and a MacBook, and we are 100% Google. So they all use Apple devices to access the Google ecosystem, because iWorks is really flaky when you get into trying to collaborate. So
to answer my own question, I thought the whole thing was transformational, because I was sitting there as an insurance underwriter, and I took my first online class, and I was like, oh my gosh, everything is about to completely change. And that's when, you know, Web 2.0 was just coming out, and the fact that I could talk to, I don't know, Jeff, if you were where you were, I guess you were in New Hampshire a bit, and wherever you were, and Dave's in Canada. I mean, I was like, this is unreal. Yeah, I can have like study groups in college, and I was able to, you know, see my professor, but to be able to connect at a distance and time shift, time didn't matter. I could do things, respond to a discussion board 3 hours after somebody else posted it. All those things to me just felt this big. And then like over the course of the 20 years, I feel like I've either had to be a salesperson for that, or to like respond to the negative consequences of that. Twitter. Let's say Twitter. Remember how excited we were the first night of Twitter? I don't know if we thought it would like change, you know, geopolitical, whatever, to this extent. And maybe it has. I don't know. I don't think I was thinking of that when we were laughing about people telling I had a bagel for breakfast, I think is kind of the extent of the conversation.
I think it's smartphones more than social media. Remember, we were on Twitter for 3 years before the iPhone came out. Right. And if you think about how mobile devices, I mean, just not having to burn podcasts onto CDs so you can listen to them in the car, you know, saved me hours a week. That whole connected everywhere all the time, I think, was maybe as transformational as social media and the ability for everyone to be a publisher and everybody to share this thing with the world, or as much of the world as wants to pay attention to it.
It's fun to reminisce about transformational moments as a Gen Xer. You know, the first one was Pong. Gopher.
I love Gopher, and Gopher is on my list.
Which, for those who don't know, was the internet before the World Wide Web, text-based tool out of Minnesota, I believe. And that was like, wow, oh, okay, I can get information about anything.
So if I can talk about that for a second, pre-Gopher, right? If you wanted information, you had to guess where it was and then go check. Right.
Yeah.
I'm going to FTP to, you know, Washington University in St. Louis and see what's on their server. And if there's anything there I might be interested in. Gopher was the first time you could actually create like a menu or a table of contents that actually pointed to different places on the internet and connected things together. That was
real player was.
Sorry, real I was just going to say there are three things, right? There's, you say Gopher. I think of it as the Apache Foundation, but whatever. I can put a thing up. There's search. I can find a thing. And then there's, I can get to the thing. So the phone, right? To me, it's those three pieces together that you're, when I hear Jeff talk about it, those are the elements of it, right? Like I can put it up online so people can see it. I can find it. So that difference between the guessing that John's talking about, and then the phone thing that John was talking about, where then no matter where I am, I can do the searching thing to find the posting thing.
For me, the next transformation was real player and real audio, and realizing that, oh, I can actually publish audio, and like there can be this global conversation. And then it was like Net2Meeting, or I forget what it was called, but it was like the first early Skype kind of thing, where living in Korea, all of a sudden I could talk to my family and friends for free, as opposed to paying, you know, $1.50 a minute. And then, like, when I think about the phone and the whole social media thing, that was more incremental. In the big picture, it was transformational, but I didn't have a moment of like, oh, wow, Twitter's going to change the world, or Facebook. You know, it's like there was just this flood of new tools and sites and, oh, things are becoming more social. That was the frog getting boiled in the pot of water. It wasn't like an all of a sudden, wow.
So how is that similar or different to where we're sitting now with AI? Like, how do you view it? Say it's EdTech Weekly and Jeff puts in a link. Look at this new ChatGPT thing. What are we going to do with this? Like, how does that all fit in with what we've seen?
I think the most important thing is that it collapses two of the three things that I was suggesting are the most important ones. So it collapses search and content. So it removes the where the thing came from and who actually made it. And that's where I think 20 years from now, that's where we'll see the huge implications, is that it wipes out the human, right? It may have come from humans and eventually it won't. So if you look at, you know, what Tigran Nebru would say, that we're going to get to the point where it's going to be AI looking to AI generated text that look to AI generated text to create AI generated text. So I think in the long run, that's the huge piece. On a day-to-day basis, I mean, it's going to lead to some bad report writing, but a lot of bad reports are already out there now. I'm not sure that the balance is going to be worse reports. Jen, like, I think when it... Go ahead. Sorry.
If Jen doesn't mind, I had a question that I actually kind of wrote down. You were in the chapter talking about the example of a child looking for how does a giraffe sleep?
Mm-hmm.
And you conclude that part by saying the internet is not an abundance of information we want. It's an abundance of all information, which to me, okay, does that mean the information isn't useful? To me, it made me think about curation and the value of either verified or some kind of human checked source of information. And I thought of like Wikipedia. So Wikipedia isn't perfect, but
pretty great, though.
It's pretty great. And there's a level of curation that I trust more than just some random YouTube video. Totally. So in this world of AI, generating content from AI, is there hope for some kind of human involved curation that will aid that validity and trust?
I mean, that'd be great. That'd be great. I mean, you remember when we interviewed Larry Sanger about this, right? In 2006. Do you remember that conversation? Where he was like, Wikipedia was only the training program. What we really wanted to do was build Newpedia, which was all expert vetted material so that we could have a trustworthy place to have on the internet. And Wikipedia was supposed to be that. But I can't imagine how they would have negotiated difficult dialogues in that model, right? Like, I don't know how they would have negotiated the current crisis in the Middle East, or any crisis in the Middle East, let's face it. Like, I don't know how
it
that
seems
gets negotiated
doable.
By experts.
Like, it seems like you could say, all right, here are a variety of perspectives, and here's this person's background, and here's what you need to know to kind of fully understand where they're coming from, and here's five different ones. You can
Except
make up your own opinion.
In that model, he was paying people. So then you have to go out and pay experts, which ends up being different than a whole community coming together with different voices. Like, I think the money there makes it harder. Because then somebody has to choose which experts they're going to hire, rather than everybody with a vested interest comes in and has a voice, which is what Wikipedia looks like, which I think turns out much better. I think Wikipedia is the most amazing thing the internet ever made. And I think it's amazing. And I will defend it and stomp the floor for it every day, because it's still better than almost anything else you're going to use. It's better than AI.
Is Wikipedia still banned in K-12 schools, John, or anyone?
No, it's I see more pushback in higher ed. Dave can fight me on this, but I think the arguments against Wikipedia that we were having in K-12, you know, 15 years ago, were still around at least right before the pandemic at higher ed, in terms of I think K-12 gave up on vetting sources at some point and just kind of threw their hands up with the I came from the internet and would just leave it at that. Whereas higher ed, I think, wants things to be better cited. And so, you know, and Wikipedia is cited, but it's, you know, well, let's look at the value of these things that are in the footnotes and, you know, make sure that it's all reliable information. At least that was my impression from talking with college professors, you know, before the pandemic.
Do you ban many sites, John, like YouTube or any other?
No. You know, the law says we have to ban stuff that is harmful to minors, child pornography, and obscene. And there are a lot of gray areas there, but for the most part, we leave most of the stuff unless it creates a problem, you know, or
something to learn from that, right? Because we certainly talked back in the day, things were banned a lot, right? Teachers would try to use something at school and would not be able to do it. You know, we'd talk about some new technology and they wouldn't even, you know, one thing I think if I had to critique us over the last 20 years, we were so, and Jeff, I love that you're positive and we're always very positive. But we're coming from a very specific, you know, we all can afford the internet. We can all afford good computers or whatever. And we probably don't spend sufficient amount of time talking about those that can't. And then probably all these privacy concerns and safety concerns and what are they doing with data that we have and things like that. So, you know, again, I feel like the negative Nelly and Jeff is like super positive always, but like, how do
you're
you
beating that? It out of me.
I know. Sorry.
We won't we'll be make a grumpy old man out of him yet.
That's right. But, you know, how does that all come into play as far as, you know, they're going to be collecting a ton of data on us now. Where every time you put in a prompt, somebody's storing what you ask the same way Google or whoever stores what your searches are. Are these things we need to worry about? And is it much different than what we've had to worry about in the last 20 years?
Search histories are pretty stark business, man. Have you ever done them on Google, on the Google Trends?
I'm sorry, what is it?
On Google Trends, when you go through and see what the histories of what people have searched, because this is the same thing that happens on Google, right? They record mm-hmm. every search and then
right.
that data is available. Those patterns are a little scary already.
Well, and on the individual level, I don't know if you guys saw the Social Dilemma on Netflix, but it talks about how these, you know, companies track, they know when you broke up with your partner and what, mm-hmm. you know, when you're a cycle, it like they know way too much on the individual level, all, you know, based on serving up the right amount of engagement and commercial mm-hmm. content.
So maybe the way to leave it is there are positives and there are potential negative consequences. And we just have to think about those as we're rolling things out.
I just want to know which of the thousands of periodic table apps actually survived the test of time.
Stay tuned. We'll get back to you on that. So, I mean, the title, change has never been a bargain.
Yep.
All right. Pollyanna, Jeff. Like, would any of us want to go back to 50 years ago level of technology? I mean, yeah, there is good and bad, and there are concerns on an individual and a societal level. But I like being able to have a conversation with you guys for free, and I like all the stuff Absolutely. I can do in 2024. Mm-hmm. Great bargain, and I pay so little. I'm sold. It is a bargain.
So I'm just going to read the quote that it comes from. So progress has never been a bargain. You have to pay for it. Sometimes I think there's a man who sits behind a counter and says, all right, you can have a telephone, but you lose privacy and the charm of distance. So it's not saying that it's not good. It's that it's not without challenges. That's right. You're trading one thing for another all the time. Right. So it's not that. And the key there is to take a look at what we're trading. And ask ourselves, what is it that we valued about what was there before? So I'll give you an example. To me, one of the huge trade-offs is boredom. We've lost the necessity of boredom. Anybody who has, and to Jen's comments, and we should say it more often, if you have access to the technology, if you've got the connectivity, if you've got those things, if you have that, you no longer ever need to be bored. And on the surface, you're like, whew, no more boredom. Certainly me at 7 years old, kicking around my backyard in northern New Brunswick would have been ecstatic about that, right? But the lack of boredom really troubles your ability to be creative, right? So if you just feed your spare time with whatever comes at you, whatever you can get, you don't have those moments of, hey, you know what? I'm just going to think my way through that. Or like I tell my 18-year-old, I can't believe I'm saying that, 18-year-old, the reason you can never remember to do something is because there's never any quiet in your mind for those things to come back to you, for you to remember you need to do them.
Did you always remember to do things when you were 18?
Definitely not. Definitely not. What I'm saying is that boredom can get filled in a variety of ways. I had the choice to fill in a bunch of ways, and I certainly got less and less productive doing that as I got older. But now, in order to be bored, you have to make the effort. That was not an effort I had to make when I was sitting in my basement when I was 16. But I have to make an effort to be bored. I have to actually choose the quiet.
Fair enough. And I think there,
which is a great skill, and I think it's great. And that's all I'm saying.
Right.
And if you think it's valuable, then
you get to choose it.
Hold on to it.
Right. To me, a bargain is getting something valuable at a good price. And
so
to
you're,
me, I feel
you're using different definitions of bargain.
Okay.
Dave is just saying you're trading something to get the cool stuff.
Absolutely. It's never been free.
Never been free.
It's a bad one.
But the other thing I notice in my students is like there's a certain human capacity to naturally compensate. And I see in my students how much they enjoy vinyl, how many are taking photos with traditional cameras, how many are not online. I would say a good 30%-ish, just a guess, are not on Instagram, do not have any social media because they are aware of the effect. So, and like, there's a certain premium placed on, oh, we're doing like an old folksy, we're going to go offline for 3 hours. So like, I feel like there's still a human capacity to compensate in some ways.
But my kid found
you're supporting exactly what they're choosing to do it.
Right.
And that's what I'm saying. So when you think about what you need to teach a child, 40 years ago, I didn't need to tell you to choose to find a place that didn't have entertainment that was specifically aligned to you. I didn't have to have that conversation with you. I had to have the obvious one. You're bored. Can we just find you something to do? Now it's the opposite. So it's not that one is necessarily better or worse than the other. I think the current state probably is a little better. I'm just saying that the lesson is different. And so if we're teaching those kids inside of a school, just to use a random place example, if we're teaching them inside of a school, we have different lessons that they need to learn because of the information ecosystem they live in.
And you're saying the system is not doing that very well.
I don't know if it can.
Best domain name we ever came up with was Trust in Education, Teaching Responsible Use of Social Technology. Didn't go anywhere, but great name.
Good name.
But that's, I think, too, they learn. This is people within the system learn. And kind of like what we were talking about last week is folks have seen some of the negative consequences potentially of having Facebook or whatever it might be. And so they learn, and a certain percentage kind of falls off. And plus, it's not necessarily that bright, shiny object that it was to us 20 years. And so it's like, oh, yeah, either they were born knowing it and it was always a given versus us kind of like poking around and seeing what it's all about.
The bright, shiny objects are the novel things, right? That's part of why vinyl is researched. My kid found a camcorder in the basement, said, hey, can I use this? I found some, because there were some unopened new tapes. I said, why don't you just use your phone? And they said, well, but I want to try to, I said, go ahead. They can't figure out how to put the tape in, which is hilarious. So,
and rewind.
But it's the novelty thing, right? It's not the same thing that they're used to. And that's what makes it cool. That's why we have a Victrola.
Do.
But Jeff, I'm positive. I would not be hanging around here if I wasn't positive about the potential.
Thanks for keeping hope alive.
Aww.
That's right.
See, there's two of them, dude.
Don't get me started, though. I could tell you all the things that are going to go wrong.
Yeah, and I guess the point of that, to go back all the way back to where Jen was asked the question she asked at the start, why this chapter here? the point is to talk about how those things have changed and the differences that are out there. The very conversation we just had, and we had a much more tactical conversation than most people are going to have. This real player probably won't come up in every one of those. Or the Apache Foundation, like, but at the end of the day, those changes are ones that people have felt, right? They felt that their privacy is certainly different than it used to be, right? The ways in which people are trying to scam you are a little bit more complex than they used to be. But at the same time, my mom got phone scammed the other day, which is, you know, 70 years old. Mm-hmm. We've been doing that forever. So it's not like a fully all the time, but I think people's relationship to how they get information, people's relationship to how they learn things, people's relationship to how they deal with political issues, those are the ones I really care about. And I think it's the stuff we do the most. So I'm right now still trying to write this piece about training people for the stuff they don't care about, which is the vast majority of the training, the teaching that we do. We teach people for the things they're not going to be experts in. For that stuff, I think it's where it really matters, because we're going to go out and use not that book that Jeff learned that probably had all the characters right before it came to him to learn Korean, but random information, which when there's a right answer, like what are the 24 Hangul characters, is fine. But when it's something you need to vote on, or who to vote for, yeah, who to vote for, it's got to be close to you guys right now. I mean, you're running up against the information ecosystem right now in the States is unbelievable. Right? How does anybody manage that?
Is it that much better in Canada?
We're just not as everything's. It's like Texas. Like, you guys are the Texas of Canada. Everything's just bigger in the United States. Like, yes, we have a big problem here. We have the same political shifts. We've got the leader of the Conservative Party hanging out with white nationalists, and like, we've got problems. It's just not as like. With the court cases and like 24/7, like I was on CNN today for 5 minutes and I saw a ticker tape of every word somebody was saying inside of a courtroom. Like, we just can't manage that here. We don't have the attention span.
We make our politics a reality show like no one else.
That's right. All right.
So what's coming up next week? Give us a trailer.
What's
Abundance.
Our second chapter, Abundance.
He's got to go. It's Abundance. I just checked in the book.
Gotta go look.
Yeah. Abundance, that whole thing is about how it's the thing the technology gives us. So the first thing is how the technology impacts things. And then the thing the technology, I think, most impacts is abundance, which goes back to those three things I was talking about. The Apache Foundation, or I can now post things. Anybody can post things on the internet. Search, anybody can find things on the internet. And then let's call it cell phones. Anybody can get access to do those things. It means that we have all of this information all the time. And it used to be that the precious bit of information you had about the cool restaurant was, you know, a thing that you could trade on. Whereas now I'm in a group of 50,000 people in my local community that only has like 400,000, but there are like 50,000 people in this Facebook group constantly talking about every restaurant anybody's ever been to. And it's just a different problem, right? And I think that's the difference we all deal with. And I think it has a huge number of knock-on effects in terms of how we interact with each other, how we conserve or preserve our sanity or whatever. Like, even Drew, we're talking about with the politics, right? It's not that it's the first time any election in any country has been fraught. It's that you just have so much more of it.
How did we forget? We forgot one, guys. The ability to scale and MOOCs. We didn't say the word MOOC in our transformative, whatever happened to MOOCs? They're supposed to disrupt education as we know it. Have they? Are they?
Every time I hear somebody talk about it, he apologizes.
It's true, I do. I think there are places where, first of all, the only people who are talking about disruption were people trying to sell you something.
Sure. David Brooks, New York Times.
Yeah, it was that kind of thing, right? There'll only be 10 universities at some point. And nobody who was serious about any of this thought that. I think the real potential was in places where scaling was needed. So like there's been huge successes in places like Malaysia and India, and Indonesia has had huge successes with it. I think there are places where they've managed to do some good work.
Well, I think it ties into what you were saying. Are we using MOOCs to learn, or are we using MOOCs to accredit? And I think the accrediting side was a big challenge and didn't scale necessarily in the United States. Maybe, like you said, some arguments. But the learning part, I think, yeah, I've been able to do a lot of informal learning on your own. Yeah.
I think the challenge of connecting is also wrapped up in that. I mean, if education were just about disseminating content, then MOOCs are easy, right? You just disseminate the content to everybody. It's that, what am I doing with this? How am I reflecting on it? How am I applying it? How am I using that knowledge to create something new? That's where things get super difficult, because you need to be in a community of practice to make that happen.
Nice little ball. Thank you.
All right. So tune in next week. Our conversation continues with Chapter 2, Abundance.